This podcast is brought to you by PrideNZ.com in association with the People of Colour Decolonisation Hui.
What I'd like to do is, I've got approximately an hour, I believe. What I'd like to do is talk to you a bit about my PhD research, which I completed last year. what doesn't kill you makes you stronger or something, you know? Dr. Ruth, yeah. And, yes, always willing to give advice. I might have to be careful with what I say. Hey, that is being recorded. And so what I'd like to do is sort of share with you how I came to do the research, some of the framing around the research and why I chose those ways of doing things. And then what I'd like to do is actually give you the actual stuff that women have said and the thing that nurses have said. And I just like to divide us into groups, get people talking, and then bring you all together and then have a talk about that. So I was thinking of using that hour in that way. Does that sound all right? And so it's going to sound a little bit teacherly at the beginning, but I'd really like it to be a conversation. And from my own experience, it's kind of like if one person doesn't understand something, usually more than one don't. So if there's anything that doesn't make sense, I'd be really happy for it to be a conversation rather than me talking about something that you don't know what I'm talking about. Does that make sense? So, so what I'd like to talk about is my field is maternity, and it's actually mental health, and it's maternity and it's migration. So one of the things that I decided to do for my PhD, I was working at National Women's Hospital in Auckland, and what I decided was I'd been working in mental health for about 13 years by that point, and I thought, I want to go and see some happy endings. I want to go and see, you know, be in a setting where I can make a difference to people. So I went to work on a postnatal ward. And one of the things that really shocked me was the ways in which routinized care was actually quite harmful to women and their babies. And at the time, there were lots of women from Asia who were using services more and more. And I became quite concerned about the sort of taken for granted ways in which we delivered care that seemed to automatically have a negative impact on women. So what I'm very, very interested in is how institutions shape subjectivity. So I'm going to talk about that some more. So just to give you an example, one of the things that we routinely did, and you will have some understanding of these things with your background in reproductive health, was when women had a baby, we'd sort of go around and we'd say, here's an ice pack. So it was a block of ice wrapped in cloth, and we'd say to women, pop this on your perineum, dear. Does everyone know what a perineum is? Yeah? No one? Yeah? So that's the area between your clitoris and your bum. Thank you. Yeah, further around. Under. Okay. And for lots of you know, female bodies, it was kind of, well, we stay warm when we've had a baby. We don't want anything cold near us. Yeah? So that's a tradition in many parts of the world. The other big thing was in many of our cultures, when you have a baby, you're someone who's really special, you've been through heaps, and everyone is supposed to just love you, honour you, and pamper you, right? And in New Zealand, it's kind of like, you've had your baby, get on with it, feed your baby, change your baby. We want you to become as independent as soon as possible. So, you know, I was seeing all the ways in which there are these culture clashes. And these culture clashes were frustrating for my colleagues, and they're incredibly frustrating for women. You know, and every woman of colour that I passed by would look at me beseechingly. You know, so it's kind of like, save me. You know, this place is not treating me well. So this fantasy I had of maternity as this place where we could really honour women became completely trashed. So what I decided to do was talk to women about their experiences, and I decided to talk to health professionals about their experiences about having a baby, looking after women. And so what I did was, I've been teaching Plunket nurses, who are child health nurses, about postnatal depression for about 18 years. So that's my field, specifically. And I arranged focus groups with health professionals, and I had focus groups with women from Iraq, Palestine, China, Korea, India, the UK, the US, and South Africa. So, you know, quite a range of women. And a lot of women also fundraised for this project. So it was a real labor of love, you know, lots of voluntary time. So these are the kinds of questions that I wanted to ask in my research. Because, you know, what reproduction means is not just this individual moment. It's about what kind of society are we recreating? Yeah? What kind of hegemonic values and beliefs are we replicating? And if your subjectivity, your personhood, has been formed in a different context, what does it mean to be inserted into the machinery? Sorry.
No, you're right.
What does it mean to be inserted? into the machinery of the system that what I learned was very factory-like. So we're trying to produce a particular type of person, you know, and I see this in terms of my own nursing education. So I started my nursing education in 1984. Oh heck, I've given away my age. And you know, one of the things that my PhD supervisor, who's in Seattle, said, to, you know, he's written about this. He said, it doesn't matter what the raw materials are, they're forced into this curriculum machine, which is shaped by whiteness and colonization, that produces a universal nurse. So if you think about our academic organizations, we talk about the critique and conscience of society, but they're converting various raw materials into some kind of standardized person, yeah? Oh, stop it! I'm blushing! And then I had questions like, we talk about biculturalism, we talk about tertiliti. So, but what does it mean when we, you know, nurses were the ones that said cultural safety? That's when the end user of the service decides that the service has been appropriate, it's met their needs. What does it mean in a New Zealand context, really, with people of colour, women of colour, who aren't Māori? So these are the kinds of things that I was interested in. And this liberal feminist idea of birth as transformational for women, does it actually get realised for women of colour? So I was really interested in those kinds of questions. Is everyone still with me?
Mm.
Okay. Anytime I get boring, just do this. Yeah? So... oh, shit. That was fast. Okay. So I told you I did these focus groups and they're a starting point. But what I started becoming interested in is, where did these ideas come from? So Michel Foucault, the French theorist, talks about the history of the present. How do we come to have these ideas? Because they're not new. They've all come from somewhere. And he talks about a genealogical method to look at how things come into being. So I decided to look at that about maternity. And I'm also interested in the idea of discourse, which I'm going to tell you about, which is that actually we don't have any individual ideas, okay? So I'm just thinking of those of you that are parents. I'm not a parent, but I have lots of little people in my life, and they just repeat everything that's said in the environment, don't they? Would you agree with you, those of you that are parents? So I reckon, even as adults, we do the same thing. When we're saying something, we're reproducing something that we've caught in our antennae, that we've heard around us, and we repeat it. And we don't always critique it. It becomes taken for granted. But there are a whole lot of ideas and concepts that are mobilized, you know. And Belinda, you talked about stereotypes yesterday. You know, there are things that we might not even be conscious of, but we draw them down and they become part of us, yeah? And they live in our bodies. So I was interested in what kind of discourses are mobilized. Hey, and if anyone wants any of these notes, I'm really happy to email them to you or anything like that. What kind of discourses are mobilized? And so I want to take you through the idea of discourses and discourse analysis, because it's something I've become really interested in as a, where's our textual friend? So, you know, you'll find this interesting, you know, the idea of text, and I'm going to give you some text because I thought of you last night and text. So it's kind of about, can we deconstruct the relationships, conditions and mechanisms of power and identify how they emerge? So discourses make available particular ways of seeing the world, particular stories about things. And I'm going to give you an example in a minute, so don't get worried about that definition. So what I wanted to do was to say, okay, what are the kinds of discourses about migrant mothers? Yeah? Where did those ideas come from? And what are the impacts of those ways of thinking? And are there some other ways of thinking about them? Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to show you some examples of discourse and text by showing you some pictures. Now, these are pictures of a very heterosexual, generally, event that's coming up next week, Valentine's Day. Okay? And what I realised is that they might also trigger people, so I just want to apologise about that because they do have a particular version of love or relationship that might be upsetting. So please look after yourself if something does come up. Okay? So when you look at this, what does this say to you about a relationship between a man and a woman and Valentine's?
Psycho.
Psycho. Power and control?
Ownership.
Sorry? Ownership. Absolutely. Okay, so I want you to just throw out your ideas, but these were sort of, you know, these are real cards from the 50s, okay?
It's also like it's inevitable.
It's inevitable.
You grow up and practice doing what can be
said. Exactly.
No consent, eh?
Exactly. Yeah, yes. No consent. What about this one? This says, I aim to please you, my Valentine.
It's just
terrible. Parental? Pardon? Baby's first word, did you say?
Face first.
I think my ears are painted on. I can't hear you.
The face.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like it had a face first.
Yeah.
Oh.
Could be. Okay, I'll read this one for you in case you can't see it. You built a wall so fast and strong, but with my magic ray, it won't last long.
Oh my God.
So, you know.
Ew.
Are you starting? Pardon? Yeah. 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 See, there's a theme, eh?
Romantic, though. You know,
yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Okay. I'm out hunting for a Valentine. Are you game?
Are you game?
Are you
consenting to be hunted by me?
Yeah. You're an animal. You're cute.
It reminds me of the book that was probably one of the first novels I read. That was the novel, and how women are often displayed as game, as catch, as food, as delicious, juicy, hot ass. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you're starting to talk about are the kind of discourses, yeah? So I'm just trying to give you a sense of what are the kinds of ways we frame relationships and heterosexual relationships in Valentine's cards, say, in the 50s. But, you know, these would have been... Sorry? Yeah, but you know, I'm just... You know, this is kind of a little bit extreme, but it's to try and get you thinking about the idea of discourse as sort of a way of thinking that's circulating and that's socially kind of constructed. Is that kind of coming through?
Yeah, I was talking about
images
of children. Yeah. I saw a novel about Disney the other night, and they were talking about the similar kind of things, like on children. So Beauty and the Beast, there was a broom and a candle.
So there's all these ways of thinking that you know, you can deconstruct and start sort of thinking about what were the dominant ideas of the time about how relationships work. So that's kind of the point I'm trying to make here. This one, I'm bound to be yours if you'll be mine. Yeah? what's a safe word? Okay, and then, you know, yesterday you saw that one about the yellow peril. Here's another one. So what do you see when you see this? I'll just read out to you in case you can't see it. At the bottom it says the Hindu, spelled H-I-N-D-O-O, peril. Small politicians open the door. And this guy is the imperial politician. White New Zealand policy. How is the other, who's Indian in this case, or South Asian, how are they framed in this picture?
Like a monster.
They're a monster. They're much bigger, aren't they?
Like,
look how big their foot is in the door. Yeah? Sorry? Yeah, it's a scary, it's scary.
But it's also from a white man saying that they're small, so it's sort of implying that it takes someone, you know, with big kahunas to be a racist openly.
Yeah.
And they're not willing to be, so they're kind of small. Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
And also the truth, since it's too big, it's true that the new elder of the community came to very small,
And the other thing that I find is really interesting, you know, and the New Zealand First politician who I challenged this morning was not very impressed with me at all. But the other thing that I find interesting is the way in which those kind of metaphors are evoked. You know, the yellow peril, dangerous, infectious, contaminating, untreatable, you know?
Continuous.
Exactly, all of those things. Now, I just want to sort of shift that idea of discourses. I'm just trying to take you a bit on a journey, right? To think about alcohol and drug use. You know, one of my first job was working in a methadone clinic, you know, and I'm very interested in the kind of different discourses around drugs and addiction. And so I'm trying to just sort of give you a bit of a sense of what I'm talking about when I talk about discourse before we move into my material, okay? Is this helpful? Is this kind of, yeah? So a moral discourse about drug use is that, you know, if you use drugs, you're bad, you're evil, you know, it's a moral weakness using drugs. And the kind of treatment or the mechanism to correct it is to persuade the drug user that it's a bad thing to do, yeah? And the impact stigmatisation, the person's sort of considered a lesser citizen and punished, you know, so it's criminal, right? Disease discourse, well, the drugs are okay, but some people can't cope with the drug. So the person has a predisposition, so we should protect them from the drug, hence the abstinence model, yeah, the AA-NA model. And then if people abstain, then they'll be fine. You know, and for some people, the drug's okay. And then pharmacological discourses, drugs are dangerous and overpowering. You know, we need to protect people from them. We have legislation. And people are victims who might use the drug. Yeah, so you have legislation. Again, some of the AA-NA discourses, you know, we are powerless over drug use, etc. Yeah? And in fact, it's much more complicated. It's more of a triangle. There's no one causative thing. Yeah? And there's a relationship of factors. So I'm just trying to give you a sense of the different ways in which, you know, discourses work in different areas. So what I want to do now, if I can, is, are you all right if I divide you into groups and give you something to do? Yeah? And what I'd like to do is, first of all, give you some quotes from Plunkett nurses, and I'd like you to kind of just have a think about them. So I'm wondering,